the way the talk will be organized is that I'll probably just take about half an hour to go over general things and then to allow time for some specific questions, because I think most of the time when I do these talks, the questioning part is the most interesting part. People have lots of questions about their own preventive health care concerns. I think in terms of preventive health care, there's been a big shift since about the mid-1900s, or about the early part of the 1900s, in terms of what kinds of things that we die from. We know that before 1930 or 1900, that the majority of deaths were from infectious diseases. Pneumonia and tuberculosis were the number one killers, including a number of childhood illnesses. But as of the 1950s, when in 1952 penicillin came on board that we were and was made available, and other antibiotics soon became available after that, we have a number of antibiotics available, including that those for the treatment of tuberculosis, such that the incidence of death from infectious disease has dropped dramatically. Now the major causes of death are heart disease, which accounts for about 50% of deaths, and cancers. In younger ages, it's also injuries and some infections still in the childhood and particularly in the first year of life. But there's been a big shift from those that are sort of acute infectious processes to those that are heart disease and cancer that may be related to our lifetime health habits and not to some exposure we got at a discrete point in time. Let's return to my notes here for a minute. So consequently, because of the incidence of heart disease and cancers, there's a big effort to try to both prevent those primarily, meaning by decreasing fat in one's diet, not smoking, for example, and maintaining a normal blood pressure, that those things will reduce your risk of heart disease. And that's what we refer to as sort of primary prevention, trying to prevent the disease from occurring at all. Then there's also been an emphasis on secondary prevention, which is trying to identify diseases at an early stage when they're treatable. The most successful example of that would be in terms of identification of cervical cancer in women through the Pap smear, which is well proven as a good preventive maneuver. The one might ask, how do we determine which diseases to try to screen for and to expend healthcare dollars in terms of screening? And those are usually diseases that have a great impact, meaning they many people are affected by them. Those would include, in terms of cancers, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, cervical cancer in women, and lung cancer, and prostate cancer as being the major causes of death from cancer. The other thing is to know whether identifying a disease at an early stage has a better outcome than waiting until symptoms were to occur. And that's where there's some areas of controversy. A current example would be in prostate cancer, because there's little known about what is an effective treatment with low risk for prostate cancer. So that one of the things holding up massive recommendations for universal screening for prostate cancer in men is the lack of good evidence that the treatments are effective and acceptable to men who would be affected. So there should be evidence not only that the disease affects a large number of people, but also that the disease has a treatment that's effective and acceptable is an important point. The other point is the characteristics of the screening test itself, that it should be able to identify people much earlier than they would if they just waited until symptoms developed. That the risk of having a falsely positive test, meaning that if you have a a screening example for PSA, which is a prostate-specific antigen test for prostate cancer, that then you'd hope that the majority of people who have a positive test do have prostate cancer. Unfortunately, in that particular example, as we'll go into in greater depth later, it's only about 20 or 30% of those men overall who do have prostate cancer. So there's not a very, having a positive PSA test or prostate specific antigen doesn't really tell you of all those men who have a positive test, only the minority are really going to have cancer. But that's actually fairly true for a number of other preventive health care tests. So those are some general comments about the kinds of diseases that we screen for and the characteristics of the screening test that one would hope for. Another issue I'd like to raise is sort of the history of preventive health care in medicine. That back in the early 1900s, a lot of preventive health care actually occurred outside of the medical profession, and particularly in health foods. Graham crackers actually started as a high-fiber cracker that was recommended as being good for your health starting in the early 1900s. I don't think it has that much fiber in it these days. But Dr. Graham was the person who invented graham crackers. But things have gained momentum since about the 1960s, that there's been an increased effort to encourage preventive health care and having that acceptable within the medical profession. Actually, starting a bit earlier than that, in about 1940 or 50, the AMA, American Medical Association, came out with a recommendation that everyone have a preventive health care complete physical examination once a year. And that's what we lived with for a long time, the old idea of an annual physical examination. Unfortunately, that wasn't based on much scientific evidence that was beneficial, or that that the patient's or the physician's time or the healthcare dollars were spent well doing that. Now, there's been much more evidence collected to show that there's specific things that are very useful to be screened for, to have examinations for, but that you don't need to have a head-to-toe physical examination every year. We still sort of hang on to that and say that men, that generally a head-to-toe examination in men and women should be done about every 3 or 4 years between the ages of 20 and 40, and between 40 and 50 or 55 should be done about every 2 to 3 years, and after that every 1 to 2 years. Now that's just the head-to-toe examination. You might want to have more, probably should have more frequent examinations, for example, for a pap smear than that, but you don't need to have a head-to-toe examination. So the shift has been away from a general physical examination towards specific targeting of specific parts of the body to look for early signs of disease, and also to counsel people on preventing not smoking and other things that may contribute to their risk of heart disease and other diseases, and lung disease and other diseases down the road. About in 1970 or so, the Canadians were the first ones that took an organized scientific approach to this and did a comprehensive review of the scientific literature in a number of areas and came up with a number of recommendations for preventive health care. Then in the late 70s and early 80s, the U.S. Government funded a project called the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force that many of you may have heard of that has come out with a number of recommendations based upon a scientific review of the literature. And they're currently, they published their first book and set of recommendations in, 1986 or 88. And then they'll be coming out with a new issue this year or next year that will add on to what they did before and make some revised recommendations based upon newer scientific information. And then that raises the sort of the source of some conflicts or confusion in recommendations, that you have lots of different organizations making recommendations. Most of them, such as the American Cancer Society or the American Heart Association, are usually based upon what's called an expert opinion approach, where you gather 10 experts into a room and have those people come up with a recommendation for breast cancer screening or cholesterol management and those kinds of things. Usually those people, their occupations involve something related to that, and so they tend to have a vested interest. Radiologists in terms of mammograms are often the ones making recommendations for mammographic screening. And while they have a lot of experience in those areas, they also may not be looking at the scientific literature in as an objective way as possible. So that was part of the reason that this U.S. Preventive Services Task Force started, was to use what's called an evidence-based approach to review the scientific information and make what's a scientifically valid recommendation, and then also to identify those areas that need further research, where the literature, the research in medicine has not given us a good answer. So those are sort of the introductory comments. What I'd like to do next is to go over some specific healthcare recommendations, and then we'll get into some of the areas where there's also some controversy. We'll start with, these are from our own clinic. I guess I'll need to hold this, so I'll sit here. And I just brought these not to advertise our clinic, but just because that's what I have. I wrote this form back in 1991, and so it's a good thing to prompt my memory on different things. So what I'll talk about are sort of general recommendations, and then we'll get into some specific areas of controversy where I'll welcome questions, and those will be in prostate cancer screening, colorectal cancer, colon cancer, and breast cancer screening, and then hormone replacement therapy at menopause for women. The recommendations in terms of immunizations are that all authorities agree with this, is that a tetanus diphtheria vaccine should be administered about every 10 years to adults in the United States. The immunizations are fairly well conducted in the United States in childhood, but during adulthood we tend to forget about those things. And so we do know that about 10 to 20% of adults over age 60 to 65 are not protected against tetanus diphtheria. And actually the majority of cases of tetanus in the United States occur in adults. All of them occur in adults after age 60 because they've forgotten about getting an immunization. The other immunization that's useful is the influenza vaccine, which should be administered to individuals after age 65 and earlier if you have heart, lung, kidney problems of significance, diabetes. So any disease that would be a significant disease, those people should probably have an influenza vaccine every year, because they're not going to be able to handle that infection as well. Also above age 65, there's a recommendation for a pneumonia vaccine. And this first came out about 10 to 12 years ago, at which time there was, I think it was it's a vaccine that specifically covers a pneumonia called pneumococcal pneumonia. And it covered 12 different types. Now there's a vaccine that covers 24 different types of this particular kind of pneumonia. And that's recommended just once. In people who have diseases such as diabetes, where they might not respond as well to the vaccine as others, it may be prudent to have another vaccine about 6 years later. But for most adults, one time is sufficient for the pneumococcal vaccine. And then another vaccine that's important, but not, but only in certain high-risk groups, would be a hepatitis vaccine. And that's for healthcare workers who may be exposed to blood products, and people who work in nursing homes and other healthcare facilities where they may be exposed to other people's blood or body fluids. And so it's mostly recommended not for the average person, but for a certain high-risk group. So those are the immunizations. And of all the preventive maneuvers or preventive services, the immunizations are the ones where there's very good evidence that they're beneficial, and where all authorities tend to agree on those recommendations. Next, we'll go down some areas for screening and counseling. The first is blood pressure, and we should all have our blood pressure measured about every 1 to 2 years. The official recommendation is about every 2 years would be sufficient. And then if your blood pressure is elevated, you don't wait another 2 years, of course. You come in and have your blood pressure measured again to see if you have high blood pressure, because we do know that treatment of at least moderate and severe high blood pressure certainly lowers your risk of stroke and risk of heart disease. The next is cholesterol screening. And all adults after age 20 should have a cholesterol, and now it's recommended not just to have a total cholesterol, but also to have what's called an HDL cholesterol, which is the good cholesterol. Cholesterol is divided into bad cholesterol, or the total cholesterol is made up of several different fractions, and one is the bad cholesterol, or the LDL cholesterol. And the other is the HDL cholesterol, which is the good cholesterol. And then there's a couple of other fractions that I won't go into, but the ones you need to remember, what's the good cholesterol, what's the bad cholesterol. And it is recommended that you have both your total and your HDL cholesterol measured. And those tests can be done on a random blood sample, meaning that you don't have to be fasting to have accurate testing of those. In most cases. And that's recommended to have that done about every 5 years, up until about the age of 65 or 70. After that, if you've had cholesterol testing before that and had normal values in your cholesterol, it's very, very unlikely that your cholesterol is going to go up. Any further, because most elevations occur in your 20s and 30s. In early 40s is when people may have been going along at a fairly normal level, and then their level jumps up, and there's a number of reasons for that. So it's recommended that you be screened several times before age 65, but if your level has been normal, you probably don't need screening after that. Because we know levels won't go up. If you develop diabetes or some other disease that we know causes your cholesterol to go up, then certainly that should be checked. And then anyone who's had a high cholesterol before age 65 or 70 should certainly continue to be checked for that. Breast examinations in women are very important. All authorities agree that starting at age 40, women should have annual breast examinations, and those should continue on until at least age 70, and most people agree that they should continue on lifetime. There's a few groups that say, well, the evidence isn't there to support examinations after age 70, but most of it is the fact that they haven't done enough studies in that specific age group. So we advise annual breast examinations beginning at age 40. Mammograms is an area of debate, and everyone agrees that there's good evidence that mammograms are beneficial in detecting early breast cancers when they're at a curable stage beginning at age 50, and that screening should be done annually until the age of 65, and then it may be okay to spread it out to every 2 years. In fact, Medicare has adopted that point of view and only pays for mammograms every 2 years after age 65. but at least between age 50 and 65, annual mammograms should be done, and then annual or every two-year mammograms after age 65. The area where there's a lot of debate is in the group age 40 to 50, in whether those women should be screened. Most people agree that if you have a first-degree relative, meaning a sister or a mother who's had breast cancer, then you should be have a mammogram done probably every year between age 40 and 50. If you don't have those risk factors, then that's where a lot of debate is. The best designed and largest studies were done in Sweden, and there was about 2 years ago a paper that summarized all of those studies and sort of took all of the data and reanalyzed all the data, and they found that there was no benefit in low-risk women between age 40 and 49 for having a mammogram. The only at 8 years to 9 years of follow-up did there begin to be some indication that there was a benefit, but it wasn't statistically significant, meaning that it wasn't a completely valid finding. But it's also true that if you take women age 40 to 49 and you start screening those, that by 8 years, when there could be a benefit, that most of them are in the 50-year age group where you would already be recommending screening. So that right now, the scientific evidence doesn't support screening for breast cancer in low-risk women age 40 to 49. But I think it's also obviously something that needs to be worked out between yourself and your physician in terms of screening there. But my purpose is to tell you what sort of the scientific literature supports at this point. Pap smears should be done every 1 to 2 years until about age 65 to 70. After 70, most groups say that they don't need to be done unless you've had an abnormal pap smear before. If you have, then you should continue to have pap smears done. What we don't list on here is any screening for ovarian cancer, because unfortunately there is no good way of detecting ovarian cancer at an early stage right now. The next thing I list is prevention of osteoporosis, or thinning of the bones. And it's very important for adolescents and young women to consume adequate amounts of calcium, which range from about 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams a day. The average adult, including teenagers, probably only get about 500 to 600 milligrams of calcium, mostly because a lot of people don't drink milk or they're on low-fat diets trying to avoid to keep their cholesterol low. And so that can be a disservice in terms of your calcium. So it is recommended that we take adequate calcium in our diet. One glass of milk has about 300 milligrams of calcium in it, so that if you're eating an average diet and then also drinking two additional cups of milk a day, then you're up to about 1,000 milligrams, and you're probably getting into the area where you're getting enough calcium. There's some things that decrease the amount of calcium, and that is excess coffee consumption. Yes?
Isn't it true that many of these soft drinks rob the body of calcium?
I don't know what the scientific literature says on that. That was something that there were several articles about 5 years ago on the soft drinks, and it wasn't clear. I know that in the lay press there were newspaper articles about the soft drinks robbing the body of calcium, but it hasn't been proven. And some soft drinks actually advertise that they add calcium to them. Coca-Cola isn't one of them, but there are some of those. But I don't particularly advise drinking soft drinks, because they're often a source of calories, or even when they have aspartame or one of the sugar-free forms in it, that they're not, you don't need that really for your health at all. The next one is rectal examination. And rectal examinations aren't that good for looking for colon cancer. They may have some advantage in looking for early for prostate cancer. And so in men, they should probably be done. But they're not essential in females. The evidence doesn't really support, scientifically support, doing rectal examinations for looking for colon cancer in adults age 50 and above. Although most physicians do that because it's sort of habit, and also that if we do a lot of things because if by chance someone had, even though the science doesn't support that it's beneficial to do that, if by chance we miss something, then often there's a lot of liability involved in that. So unfortunately, there's always a balance between what's scientifically proven and what you also need to do sort of to protect oneself. The fecal occult blood testing, though, is a good screening test for colon cancer. And that people at age 50 and above should have an annual set of three cards given to them where they check their stool for hidden blood. And these are called hemocult cards. The only vendor of those is the people who make hemocult cards. And they're three cards, and then you're given little wooden spatulas, and you need to just sample a little part from a stool from the toilet and dab it on on this one card and close it up, and then repeat that over 3 days or a week to get three samples, and then we do a test to see if there's any evidence of blood. You don't want to do the test if you have hemorrhoids that are bleeding, because that's obviously the cause and will confuse things. So you don't want to be having bleeding hemorrhoids at the time. But there's good evidence now that annual testing is a good way of detecting colon cancer and actually reduces deaths from colon cancer. The other test is called flexible sigmoidoscopy, where there's a flexible tube that has the diameter of about 2 pencil sizes that's used to look in about the lowest 60 centimeters of the colon to see if there's any evidence of early colon cancer. And that also is a good recommendation, and there's good evidence for that. It may not need to be done as frequently as 5 years, but right now most groups are recommending that it be done every 5 years. And so there's two ways then to screen for colon cancer, and that is by the annual stool cards, and secondly, by every 5 years having this sigmoidoscopy. And then we list obvious things like avoidance of tobacco, not smoking, avoidance of excess alcohol, and other drugs. And then for adults who are sexually active, if there's multiple sexual partners, we encourage you to use some protection to protect against sexually transmitted diseases. And then finally, we advise that all adults, and this includes both anyone above age 20, should probably, with their lawyer or their physician, fill out what's called advanced directives to tell them who you would want to make decisions for you in the event that you had an illness that took away your ability to make decisions for yourself at the time because you had a major stroke or some major other illness, such as AIDS or something like that, that would decrease your ability to make a decision, and also to write down what you would want to be done for yourself if you were to become severely ill, such that the chances of living very much longer was very, very low. And because those are very useful to physicians and usually result in a lot better health care for the individuals. Because we often run into problems where someone has a major stroke and it's clear that they're not able to make decisions for themselves at the time because they perhaps can't even speak or write or communicate very well. But and then you have their opinions about what they would want done, and so you run into lots of conflicts and within the family. So those are the general recommendations that we have, which are quite sizable. A number of other recommendations that we put down here in finer print for lack of space are adequate nutrition in terms of low-fat diet, avoiding saturated fats in your diet, consuming adequate fiber in your diet, and not overdoing it on sodium. I already mentioned calcium. And then preventing injuries by wearing helmets if you ride a bicycle, and wearing seat belts if you're when you drive a car. And then remain alert for a number of other things, for dental disease, for hearing and vision impairment that may increase one's risks of falls, looking for skin changes that may suggest an early skin cancer developing, and being aware of whether or not you're feeling depressed and seek health care for that. So those are the general things that we try to go over with patients when we see them for their health maintenance visits. And that pretty much includes, a fewer number of these things need to be done for individuals 20 to 40 years of age. But since I think all of us in the room are 40 years of age or greater, I decided to choose that one to focus on. Okay, why don't I allow some time for questions right now. And then, as time permits, we can go a little bit more into some other things, but I think some other things may come up right now. Do you have any questions? Yes?
What do you think of Prozac for depression?
Well, that's not really preventive health care, but it's treatment of depression. It's a very useful medication. I tend to use Zoloft or Paxil, because they tend to have fewer side effects than Zoloft. About 10 to 15% of people develop headaches or abdominal discomfort and nausea with Prozac, or actually feel worse. Their depression's removed, but they feel anxious on the Prozac. So that Prozac was the first one that came out. But in our clinic, most people are tending to use Zoloft or Paxil, which are two other brand names that seem to treat depression just as well.
How does it, as far as cost, is Zoloft less costly than Prozac?
It's amazing that pharmacies vary a lot in price, and that At our pharmacy, it's a couple of dollars less expensive to use Zoloft than Prozac, so that's not a significant thing. We use it mostly because of that we have fewer side effects from it. But you will find, I always advise my patients that, I know what the prices are at our pharmacy. I always need to look them up. I don't have them in my head, but I can just look up and tell them what it's going to cost. But it's surprising how much pharmacies vary in price. And so I always advise patients, particularly when they're getting into something that's going to be long-term costs, such as treatment of high blood pressure with any of the more expensive medications, that they should call around to a couple or three pharmacies that they would consider using and find out what their current prices are for that.
You used
it. Oh, sorry.
I just would like to hear a little bit about triglycerides. When you have a very high triglyceride rate, that harmful to, that isn't for arteries as much as for the cholesterol. How can I get
right.
my triglyceride pump?
You asked about triglycerides, and so there's cholesterol, and then there's triglycerides. And it's generally recommended that adults' cholesterol be below 200, or that if you do have a fasting test done and know what your LDL cholesterol is, that that should be below 160. And if you have heart disease, then it should be below 130 and as close to 100 as possible. For triglycerides, the recommendation is that it be below 250. Then it's considered to be moderately elevated if it's 250 to 500. And then 500 and above is considered a significant elevation. We know that cholesterol, and particularly LDL, that elevations of those increase your risk for heart disease, and that they should be managed usually by trying to reduce your diet rather than trying to change your diet by reducing the fats in your diet, and particularly the saturated fats and cholesterol. Triglycerides is an area of there's more debate, and think the pendulum in terms of the medical literature sort of swings back and forth on this. In the 1960s, triglycerides was thought to be a significant risk factor for heart disease. But then when they did studies and reanalyzed the data and then also knew how to measure HDL, which is the good cholesterol, which is HDL is good cholesterol.
But you can call it happy day.
Yeah, happy day. Oh, that's I hadn't heard that. Happy days of living.
What's the number there?
And HDL cholesterol, the average in men is about 40, and the average, and so that's men, and the average in females is about 50. And concerning values are less than 35. And but when they measured HDL cholesterol and took that into account, then triglycerides was no longer a risk factor, because most people who have a low HDL cholesterol also have a high triglycerides. And so it was felt that the HDL was the more important factor. Now it's sort of swinging back the other direction, and it's felt now that particularly in women, a high triglycerides it is probably a risk factor for heart disease. In men, it's less of a risk factor for heart disease. And those would be for levels above 500. When your levels reach 1,000, then not only is there some risk for heart disease, but also there's a risk for pancreatitis, meaning that the fats get deposited and cause inflammation in the pancreas, which is a gland that lies right behind your belly button and lays against your back. And of course, that's what's affected in diabetes. So triglycerides both affects the pancreas, but also has risk in your for your heart. The problem is, how do you, some people though have high triglycerides and don't have any, never develop hardening of the arteries or heart disease. And so how do you figure that in? What we tend to do is people who have high triglycerides, that if there's a positive family history, or a personal history of heart disease, or if they have diabetes, then you should try to get your triglycerides down to a more reasonable level and aim for getting them down to below 250. So if someone has positive family history of diabetes and they don't respond to diet, then I would try to get their triglycerides down with medications. If on the other hand, they have no history of heart disease in their family, or they have no diabetes or other things that would be another marker for triglycerides being a risk factor for them, then you'd be less aggressive in terms of putting them on an expensive medication that has side effects in terms to get their triglycerides down.
What do you think about using garlic then
could lower your cholesterol.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things in terms of alternatives to, well, let me just sort of do it more comprehensively. And first, the first thing that there's good evidence for in terms of lowering triglycerides and lowering your cholesterol is, one is to reduce the cholesterol in your diet. And that should be about 300 milligrams a day. And one egg has about 250 milligrams. However, we know that while cholesterol, dietary cholesterol, influences your blood cholesterol, we know that more important than that is the amount of saturated fat that you take in your diet, that it actually has twice the effect on your blood cholesterol as does dietary cholesterol. So I see people who are really restricting their eggs in their diet, which may be important if they have marginal proteins intake anyway, that eggs are a good source of protein. So it might be important for them to eat the two eggs instead of just one, but to reduce the fats in their diet that we get often through meat products. So we want to have decreased saturated fats. Those usually occur in the form of meats, meaning beef and chicken, and then milk, and then dairy products, which would be high-fat cheeses and butter as sources of saturated fats. And then margarines, so they often, in order to make margarine a solid so that you can keep it a solid at room temperature, the reason it's that way is because they saturated all the fat in it. So it may have started out as being corn oil that was actually probably good, fine for you and wouldn't hurt your cholesterol. But and then they saturate it so it'll stay in a cube at room temperature, and then it's not as good for you. It's higher in saturated fats. And then you also want to have adequate polyunsaturates. Because we tend to eat more saturated fats than polyunsaturated fats in the traditional American diet. Polyunsaturated fats will help to reduce your cholesterol and may help to raise your HDL cholesterol a little bit. Polyunsaturates can help reduce your cholesterol. They also sort of reduce your HDL. And then the way we get most of these are in the forms of like peanut oil, sunflower oil, corn oil, in terms of cooking, in terms of cooking oils. The other is monounsaturated fats. Monounsaturated fats, and these are beneficial in lowering your cholesterol and also in raising your HDL level. And the sentinel example of that is olive oil. One reason the Mediterranean diet is felt to be a heart healthy diet is that it is relatively high in olive oil. But other sources are canola oil, peanut oil, avocados, which are high in fat, but to name a few examples. So those are the ways that we can change the fat components in our diet and in terms of benefiting our cholesterol. Then the other things that we can do are would be things where there's not as much data to support it, but garlic may be beneficial. There's now some studies that are even in the medical literature showing that, some benefits in garlic. Most of the studies show that garlic does certain things like lowers your cholesterol some and may keep your blood from clotting too quickly. but there haven't been studies to show whether the way that garlic does that has a benefit in terms of reducing your risk of a heart attack. So there haven't been the long-term studies that there have been with fat modification in your diet or with medications or drugs used to lower your cholesterol. So that's where the evidence for garlic is really missing. But it is known that garlic has an effect on lowering your cholesterol, and then it also thins your blood like aspirin would. And that may put you at lower risk for a heart attack or a stroke. The other thing that is chromium. That most of us probably get enough chromium through vegetables if we eat a diet that's high in vegetables. But if we have someone who doesn't really eat a lot of vegetables, then chromium may be, they may be deficient in chromium. We know now that individuals with diabetes, particularly non-insulin dependent diabetes, which is the kind of diabetes that usually occurs after age 40 or so, that that in the United States, maybe 10%, 5 to 10% of people may be deficient in chromium, and that when you replace their chromium just with a chromium tablets that you get at a health food store, that they will, their triglycerides will come down, and then they may, it may, the evidence isn't so much for this, but it may improve your diabetes control, your blood sugar control. So it's pretty clear that it will help to reduce your triglycerides. There's good studies that show that. Reduce your triglycerides, raise your HDL in the setting of insulin, non-insulin dependent diabetes, and it may help your blood sugar stay under good control. And you can measure chromium in a simple blood test, with a simple blood test, to see if one's deficient in that. In terms of the general population, doesn't seem to be quite as clear whether it benefits your cholesterol. But there's a few studies that show that it may help to raise your HDL level, but there's other studies that are equally well done that don't show that effect. And so its effect on HDL, or the good cholesterol, in the average, in someone without diabetes, it's not clear whether chromium is going to be beneficial.
Is chromium usually a part of a multivitamin?
Not the vitamins that I looked in our medicine cabinet. So I get a, you know, we bought a multiple vitamin, and this chromium's not in there. So chromium, a lot of the minerals aren't in multiple vitamins. Often they'll have iron as usually the one mineral, but they won't have zinc. Zinc may be important in wound healing, but it also, if you consume excess zinc, it can be toxic. So taking a zinc supplement a day, just one zinc, and I don't, without having a book here, I don't know the dosage of zinc. But it may be important. So iron and zinc are important sort of in wound healing. Chromium's important in terms of your, perhaps in terms of cholesterol. But the scientific evidence there, while it's there for diabetics, it's not clear for the for non-diabetics. Yes?
You know, there's pills to take to lower your cholesterol. And I'm wondering about that, if it has side effects.
Yeah, there's several different pills available for lowering your cholesterol.
Metacord one.
One is, there's niacin, which is a vitamin B3, and it definitely lowers your cholesterol and raises your HDL. It's, of all the all the cholesterol-lowering medications, it's the only one that's been studied long enough in randomized studies where at 10 years of follow-up they found that there was a decreased risk of heart disease in people taking this medication. Or a decreased risk of death. Its overall mortality was decreased. so that there's some reason for niacin to be used. The side effects, the problem with niacin is that it's not well tolerated, that you get flushing. It's sort of, I've taken it to see what it felt like, and you get this sort of prickly feeling all over your body that's very unpleasant and lasts for an hour or so. That can be controlled by raising your dose of niacin very gradually, taking your niacin regularly, whatever, two to three times a day, but on a regular basis, and avoiding hot liquids when you take the niacin. The time I took it, I just drank a cup of coffee, so I think that's why, part of the reason it caused the side effects. And then taking an aspirin a day may help to control that. So those things may make niacin more tolerable. But even in clinics where they're very good about educating people about it, and patients are very work closely with a nurse or physician, that only about 30% of people are able to tolerate niacin.
How about indigestion? Does that cause indigestion or symptoms?
Niacin can worsen ulcer symptoms. So it actually can worsen a number of things, which are common things. One is ulcers, another is diabetes, and the other is gout.
What foods do you find it in?
Niacin? Niacin's in most of the things that we eat, but it's not in high quantities that are used for treatment. So it's in meat, and I think it's in vegetables. But the main thing there is that it's in very low dose, low quantities, and it probably has nothing to do with regulating our cholesterol in low doses. You have to get your benefit in your cholesterol, you have to get up to about 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams, 1 to 2 grams of niacin a day, which is a huge amount.
Is chromium found in special vegetables or food?
Chromium is in most green vegetables. Broccoli would be an example of a green vegetable.
What is chromium on your blood test thing?
Chromium isn't a usual blood test. It's only been in the last couple of years that this information has come out. And as I said, that the data to support measuring chromium in non-diabetics is not there. I mean, some studies say it's beneficial, but other studies say it don't find an effect, a beneficial effect. So niacin, and then there's cholestyramine for cholesterol. And that is also is not tolerated very well because this regimen used to be called the fire in the sand, because the niacin caused you to feel like you're burning up, and cholestyramine tastes like it's a sandy product that you usually have to mix with pulpy orange juice or pulpy fruit juices to make it semi-palatable. But it is beneficial in lowering your cholesterol and has been shown to reduce your risk of heart disease. It doesn't show, it hasn't been shown to reduce your risk, your overall risk of death from all causes, but it has been shown to reduce your risk of heart disease death. And then the other ones are lovastatin, simvastatin, primavastatin. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of statins. They're called statins. And those are the new medications that most people are on for high cholesterol because they're well tolerated. They've been shown, not all of them have been shown or studied enough or long enough to show that it reduces your risk of heart disease. And that's part of the problem with them, that the studies that showed that by changing your cholesterol with drugs that you could reduce your risk of heart disease, those were done for niacin and cholestyramine. And then one other called gemfibrozil. But that gemfibrozil mainly benefits people who have high triglycerides. And in a large Scandinavian study, where the drug companies came to all of our offices pushing that we should recommend it for everyone with high cholesterol, that then when the further analyses of the study came out, it was shown that genfibrozil only benefited people with high triglycerides and a positive family, who had high triglycerides and a positive family history of heart disease. And those people, then genfibrozil would be a good medication, but it's not very good in lowering your cholesterol. It's mostly a triglycerides medication. Any other questions on that? Or we've been talking quite a bit about cholesterol, which it sounds like that's a very important topic for people. But yes?
Your doctors are doing a good job of keeping us alive longer, but there's so many Alzheimer's patients anymore. I mean, what's the...
what could be done to prevent?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, there's not any, in the scientific literature, there's not anything that's been shown to prevent Alzheimer's disease. There's some medications that might be helpful in people with established Alzheimer's disease, but what we all would hope would be to try to prevent Alzheimer's disease. And unfortunately, there hasn't been anything that's been proven, but it hasn't been studied that much either. So, you know, what we generally advise is doing all the things that are healthy for us and trying to reduce other things that might affect our brain function, which is we want to keep our blood vessels going to our brain working well. So keep your cholesterol normal. Don't smoke. Keep your blood pressure, importantly, under good control. And then do things that keep our minds active, so to prevent us from getting depressed which can certainly bring out symptoms of Alzheimer's disease at an earlier stage. And so keeping active, keep your mind functioning, participating in elder hostel, those things. Yes?
What are your guidelines now for exercise? It's a good preventative thing, but what are your doctors saying to people about what do you need in terms of movement things?
Yeah, that's a good question. That for movement, that in the 70s and 80s, aerobic physical activity, you know, ideally jogging as much as possible, or brisk walking to raise your heart rate, it was shown to be the most important things in preventing heart disease. But that was only looking at a small part of the kinds of diseases that can affect us and at our functioning in life. And now the pendulum is swinging back towards more conditioning exercises. And there was a good study published looking at in people after age 65, looking at whether at the benefits of weightlifting, mild weightlifting, and stretching exercises. And those people who participated in that kind of program versus a walking program actually felt better and had fewer injuries. So that I think that now the prudent thing to do is to recommend that we not just focus on one part of physical fitness, but we focus on all parts of physical fitness. Our physical fitness is determined in part by our heredity. We know that we can't all be marathon runners or Olympic athletes. Those people probably have some genetic component that allows them to utilize oxygen in a way that they can do the astounding things that they can do. But for the rest of us average citizens, then there's some things that we can do in terms of our own health habits, and those are aerobic activity, walking as much as possible, keeping flexible, and so doing stretching exercises are very important, and then also muscle strengthening exercises, including the upper body and the legs and the abdominal muscles. So I think, so things are swinging back the other way. In terms of aerobic activity, it's recommended that you try to jog or walk for about 30 minutes at least three times a week. I find that for most people, including myself, that if you don't do it every day, then it's too easy to not do it. So that often it ends up being something that you want to try to do every day.